Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The end of a stable climate, along with the end of cheap energy, could spell the end of political normalcy. If the United States election season is any guide, we may already be witnessing the early stages of a political sea change, as nativist protests against immigration and globalization in the United States and Europe, fueled in part by the failures of economies to deliver jobs and rising standards of living, have flummoxed establishment leaders. This morning, we talk again with Tom Prouve, senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and co-director of the State of the World Project, about creating a new paradigm of governance called deliberative civic engagement. We'll talk about how this forum, governing from the bottom up, may be the only way to address the potential chaos that lies ahead. Tom, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, thanks for having me, Barbara. It's nice to be on the show.
And I just want to warn you, we're in the middle of a pledge drive. So we are, and I think this is all about democracy from the bottom up, so it should all tie in quite well.
Sure.
Well, when we were talking last month, we were talking about finding ways to generate power that could come basically from local sources and be locally distributed. And at that point, you made some comment about believing that democracy had to come from the bottom up. And then since then, you sent me the blog post that you just wrote about this new form of governance. And I wonder if we could start by talking about how we get there. I mean, what does it mean to be governing from the bottom up, and how would that look different from the current political season?
Well, I guess it depends in terms of how we got there or how we get there, how far back you want to go. I think there's an argument to be made that what we call today deliberative civic engagement, which is a real chewy mouthful, and I'll just refer to it as DCE or deliberation from here on out. I think you could say it probably goes back maybe a couple million years. I think this kind of way of people coming together and discussing the problems that face them and what they ought to do about them is probably almost hardwired in our DNA by now, because it has its roots in our evolutionary history as hominids, which goes back 2 or 3 million years. I think that people have been using this way of figuring out how to make their way in the world for a long, long time. Now, being 10,000 years or so past the time of agriculture, which led to hierarchical and stratified societies and a lot of forms of government, which basically boiled down to, you know, shut up and do what you're told, it's going to be kind of hard, or it's going to be a bit of a struggle, I think, to get back governance from the bottom up. But I think it's entirely doable if people are willing to step out of the gilded cage of mere voting. Voting is a pretty limited form of political agency, but the door isn't locked. We can push it open and step out into the world of the DCE anytime we want to.
Well, and I was looking at your website, and actually I was looking for some graphics to put on our website, and I found two photographs that were shot, I'm assuming, in Salem, Oregon. It was citizens' participation in some hearings for the Department of Transportation in Oregon. And it reminded me of what I experienced when I came to Oregon, which was that there seemed to be a lot more accessibility for citizen participation in making major decisions here than I experienced when I was living back east, particularly when I was living in New York City. And you actually seem to use Oregon as a model for a lot of this kind of deliberative process. And in fact, it kind of cracked me up when I discovered a lot of the policies in Oregon state law, the way the commissions were set up. It was all this process. It reminded me of the lesbian community, actually, where, you know, you'd have 14-hour meetings going through participatory democracy.
I'm not saying it's all, you know, DCE is always exciting, but I think there are ways to make it more of a party so you can get people to keep coming.
Right.
It's
not efficient. I mean, and I think true democracy, we find that is not a real efficient way of doing things, but it's the way that when it works effectively, it makes everybody feel like they really have a stake in it. But I want to throw out this other thing, which is, as I've become more involved in a lot of participatory governance projects here in Oregon, I sometimes really feel frustrated that it's more window dressing than it's actual participation. Particularly, I've been finding that on the neighborhood association level, which, I mean, Portland has this really strong network of neighborhood associations, which have in the past had a lot of input into city decisions. And sometimes it doesn't seem like it's really working the way it should. So I wonder how we kind of meld these two things, because here in Oregon, I mean, I've been experiencing this kind of deliberative governance on some levels for over 40 years. And on the other hand, the hierarchical structures still seem to win out.
Well, I don't have a simple answer for that. I'm glad you brought up Portland, because I only know about for the Autonomous Neighborhood Associations and the District Coalition Board. I don't even know if they still call them that. Because when I was reading up about this stuff a few years ago, I read a book called The Rebirth of Urban Democracy by Barry, Portney, and Thompson. And they single out Portland and four other cities in the United States as sort of models for how this bottom-up neighborhood association method of governance has taken root and can take root in this country anyway. And it pains me to hear that. I think you've remarked in the past that you think the neighborhood associations have lost clout over the years. And I wonder about that process. I don't have any insight into it myself, but I wonder if you do.
Well, actually,
what do you think's been going on?
Well, I can speak most specifically. I mean, I've been involved in two neighborhood associations, and one of them was on the west side in this little forgotten neighborhood that was getting suffered a lot of urban renewal back in the late 60s, early 70s, and had kind of decimated its structure. And when I was living there in the 80s, we were kind of fighting for the last remnants of holding the neighborhood together. And in fact, after we moved out of there about over 20 years ago, it seemed like the neighborhood association really got the kind of plan it wanted for development, or not necessarily for development, but just kind of the zoning plans it wanted, the kinds of buildings they wanted, the kind of density. And then I moved to this other neighborhood that was a much more of an up-and-coming, kind of getting gentrified neighborhood. And there was a big, it's the same thing, the city goes through these comprehensive plans, which on the surface are a very exciting way to make decisions. But it really depends on how much your neighborhood association gets involved in standing behind what it wants. And our neighborhood association was kind of divided. In the end, we kind of came together and we got a plan that we really wanted, and it seemed very successful, and I was very happy about it. And then there was one real crucial period where they're rebuilding the bridge that connects the neighborhood to the west side, called the Selwood Bridge. And they were there was a debate whether it was going to be a two-lane bridge or a four-lane bridge. And we had just finally gotten this one street that connects to the bridge to remain a two-lane street, because there was some talk about widening it. And so that would remain a neighborhood street as opposed to just becoming a throughway for suburban commuters. So there was a big fight about how many lanes the bridge would have. And eventually the two-lane people won, that the bridge is built and it's almost opening now with two lanes. And in fact, there's more space for bikes and pedestrians than there are for cars. So that was really reflecting the values of the neighborhood. But when I went to my last neighborhood meeting a few weeks ago, that had to do with a lot of density that's being put in the neighborhood, and concerns about the height of the buildings and their inappropriateness to the existing structures in the neighborhood, it felt like the neighborhood association was kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, we don't have much power. The city, you know, does what they want. So it seems like it really has to do with who are the people on the neighborhood associations. And when you have really strong people who are going to really fight for what they know the neighbors want, then it's effective. When it's people who are just not that engaged, then it isn't effective.
I think that sums it up. I really think that if neighborhood associations want power over their community's destiny, then like any other political body, they need to slowly and insistently reclaim it from the organizations that do have it. Because I think you can think of power as a zero-sum game. If somebody gives it up, somebody else will take it and use it to their ends. So, I don't know, that sounds almost Marxist, and I'm not a Marxist, but I think that's the way things generally work. It does take deep engagement, persistent long-term engagement, steady engagement, if you will, and a sense of patience.
I mean, my thought is also, if you're frustrated with the way that your neighborhood association is running and not standing up for things you're really concerned about, get on the neighborhood association board.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know what the structure of the neighborhood associations is. I don't know if they're representative, or if they're, you know, all hands on deck, or whoever comes is a quorum and that's how decisions get made, or what. But it seems to me that based on the literature of deliberative civic engagement, a sense of inclusion and efforts to recruit people and reach out to folks who may be underrepresented is the ticket to getting buy-in and commitment and the general sense of a community being behind what the Neighborhood Association says it wants to do.
This morning we're talking with Tom Prue, who's senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and co-director of the State of the World Project, which is a bunch of books, as we just described, we're giving them away as thank you gifts this today. They're a book that comes out every year with a whole lot of different articles by different people on a different theme of sustainability. And the most recent one is called Can a City Be Sustainable, which Tom wrote several articles for, as well as editing the book. And this raised a lot of questions about doing, really reviving democracy on a very local level. It seems, Tom, that democracy works better at the city level than it does at the federal level, and I wonder if you can address that thought.
Well, that's a very broad statement. I don't know if I could get totally behind that, but I do think that one of the things that we discovered, and incidentally, I was one of three co-editors of that particular project. So Gary Gardner and Michael Renner, my colleagues at World Watch, are equally responsible or equally deserving of praise for whatever people think about it. It seems to us that it was sort of a happy accident that at the same time that the process of deliberative civic engagement seems to be blossoming around the world, that there is also a movement among cities and local governments to take up the mantle of working for climate change legislation and policy change, because that's fortuitous. DCE is a kind of governance that's ideally suited to local governing, and it turns out that the way things look anyway, most of the action in trying to address climate change and related issues is happening at the local and regional level. And I say that I know as well as everybody on your show does that, you know, the Paris Accord was signed and is the most substantive step the international community has taken towards coming to grips with climate change since basically Rio in 1992. Remains to be seen whether it'll have any teeth. And if it does wind up having teeth, I suspect it'll be in good part due to the fact that cities and regional governments have poked and prodded and made enough progress and set up the infrastructure for making policy progress toward coming to grips with climate change more than national governments. But obviously, we need progress from any origin that we can get.
Well, I see that one of the real impetuses for local communities to stand up around climate change has to do with a lot of the direct impacts of fossil fuel development hit cities, and they actually hit rural areas too, but they hit local communities. And the charismatic issue, I think, of all is the oil trains. And it's the towns and the rural communities that the oil trains go through that are threatened by oil train explosions and all the other ramifications of having oil trains go through your communities. It's really isn't felt on the federal level, and yet it's federal laws. In fact, it's actually the railroad that seems to have the most control over this. But I'm finding it fascinating to watch all these local communities passing ordinances that maybe don't have any teeth, but they have chutzpah. And how do you see that this might have a direct impact on really changing the conversation from the bottom up?
Well, it speaks to the latent political capacity and will that exists in every community, and that sometimes only emerges clearly when there is an obvious threat to the integrity of the community. But I want to emphasize that even if it only emerges at times of peril to the community or apparent peril to the community, that political capital is probably there all the time and could be mobilized for a lot of other things as well. I mean, I think in this country, we too easily succumb to the role of consumer, because it's so easy to be that in a rich country like ours, and use that to, in effect, relinquish the role of a political activist or a political agent in our communities. And I'm not saying it's an easy sell, but I do think if we want to shape the communities in the way that we think is best for not only ourselves, but for our neighbors and those that we share the community with, we need to take a more communitarian look at how to do those things. And maybe that means de-emphasizing our love for being consumers at the same time.
Well, I'm thinking about how revolutionary societies are built on a community level. And it's true. It was true in Cuba in 1959. It was really true in Nicaragua when the Sandinistas took over. And for many years, I think a lot of major decisions started at the community level. The problem with that is, though, when people are hurting for income and life becomes more and more of a struggle, there's less time to go to these community meetings. And that's one of the issues that happened in Nicaragua, as there were sanctions and the country was squeezed and poverty really was heightened. It was already a poor country, but it became even that much more stricken, and that people didn't have time anymore for these meetings. So how do we balance the two things, where particularly you're wanting to get low-income people involved in these decision-making processes, but they may be the people who have the least time to put into going to endless meetings, or not even endless meetings, just even like a meeting a week?
Oh, sure. I'm trying not to be naive about this. A universal bottom-up democracy is sort of a highly aspirational goal. There are places in the world where it ought to be happening and isn't, could be happening and isn't, like ours, at least not very extensively, because lots of us have tons of leisure and could be doing these kinds of things and shaping our communities collectively much more than we are. There are many places in the world where it's almost impossible to do that, or where the risks are both social and even physical in some cases. And I don't have blinders on about how grassroots democracy can easily triumph in places like that. But I do think it's a virtually universal impulse, and there are ways to cultivate it and nurture it and bring it out and keep it alive and keep it going. And I think we need to spend more time and energy focusing on those things.
This morning we're talking with Tom Prue, who is senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and co-director of the State of the World Project, and we're talking about how to build a society that's democratic from the bottom up. Last weekend, I was talking with a bunch of friends about what we are going to do after the election, because it seems like no matter which candidate wins the presidency, we've got some very serious issues in this country and a huge divide that we have to figure out how to deal with. And we basically were coming down to doing it, talking about how we have to basically build our power from on the community level and starting with getting to know our neighbors. And it was a kind of frustrating conversation, because I think we're all so frightened about the prospects of what's going to happen that it's hard to get grounded and really think in terms of organizing. But it seems like that is maybe the only way out of this conundrum that we have. I'm interested in talking about how you feel that the current presidential election is a reflection of maybe so much of what's gone wrong with our political system. And is there a way to rectify what's been going on by figuring out how to do really solid local organizing?
Well, incidentally, I should have put my disclaimer in here. I'm delivering my opinions, not necessarily those of World Watch Institute, because we don't actually have an official policy on any of this stuff. But I don't think I'm alone in feeling pretty disappointed with the way the current political system in the United States delivers a couple of people for us to choose, dumber, or bad or worse, or in some cases people are enthusiastic about a client or a candidate, but they're mostly so flawed or appear flawed. And I think that's virtually inevitable when you ask one person to represent the interests of 320 million people. The issue may be really that folks expect that the one candidate will reflect their own, each individual person expects that single candidate somehow to reflect everything that's important to them, or at least the one issue that is truly important to them. And I think both of those situations are virtually impossible. One issue, voters strike me as not thinking actively enough about all the matters that can affect themselves and their neighbors and their communities, and allowing themselves the indulgence, really, of choosing who to vote for on the basis of the candidate's position on a single issue, that may be however important it is, it's never the only thing that's going on. So the system, it seems to me, by not letting people engage with these issues and requiring them to engage with others with differing views in a civil, respectful way, sort of enables that kind of self-indulgence. And so we wind up with kind of a lowest common denominator political discourse that just, I don't know, I find appalling, and I think a lot of people do. It's just so low rent. I mean, it's like name calling on a playground sometimes. I won't name names, but I just think that we could do so much better, but we need to require of ourselves that that our candidates, if we're going to stick with this kind of government, which at some level we probably have to, you can't run a, I don't think you can run a country of 300 million people on a mass deliberation basis, but you can run communities on a deliberation basis, and communities can form into communities of communities, and that can trickle up to shape what happens politically at a national level.
I'm wondering kind of the same model of how do we get our neighborhood associations, how do we get our city government to recognize and become accountable to neighborhood associations, is how do we get the federal government to be accountable to state and regional and local governments as well. And the, I mean, again, thinking about the whole concern about oil trains, when there are cities and communities across the country who have passed ordinances, not ordinances because they can't do that, but passed non-binding resolutions basically calling for an end of oil trains through their communities and for the railroads to institute much more stringent safety measures than they have, and for the federal government to actually regulate the railroads. How can that become, how do we get the federal government to actually respond to these concerns, which are so vociferous and so widespread across the country?
I don't know.
I thought, yeah, the answer to that one.
I don't know. If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be on this call. I'd be writing a book. But it does strike me as it's kind of a messy situation, isn't it? Because every one of those communities, I suspect, that suffers and sees a threat in the rail lines that run, that carry those oil-laden trains through their neighborhoods. Everybody drives a car or a pickup truck, so they benefit from having a fossil fuel-run economic system in which most people get around with cars and trucks, and you got to have oil to do that. So it all, part of it, there's an aspect of NIMBYism in that. We all want to be able to go to the gas station and put gas in our cars, even, no matter whether we drive 50,000 miles a year or 5,000. Most of us don't have too many options. But we don't want to bear the risk or the shared risk of getting the oil refined and out of the ground and to those gas stations. So it's a complicated situation in which power needs to be, it seems to me, shared in a responsible way. And the only way to get the power to force somebody to take cognizance of your concerns about this is to do what they're doing, it seems to me, which is to pass the ordinances, indicate how strongly you feel about those kinds of things, make positive suggestions about how the risks can be mitigated, acknowledge perhaps at some level that you, that those communities also benefit from having access to oil and natural gas, because they do, and then just sort of own up to it. That's the kind of responsible citizenship, it seems to me, that a kind of deliberative civic engagement system would cultivate in communities.
Well, I don't think that very many people that I know anyway, and probably that many people around the United States, drive cars that are fueled by gasoline by choice. This is the only option we have. And I would feel that people would probably be very happy to either have a different source of energy fueling their cars or have I think it's harder to imagine people getting out of their cars, but if people could have electric cars that were being powered by renewable energy and that were safer and quieter and had no emissions and didn't require to have oil trains going through their communities, they would go for it. but it's not an option right now. So I guess the question is, what steps do we take to create those kinds of options? How do we envision them on a local level and then have that percolate up?
My sense of it is, again, I don't claim to have any divine insight into this at all, but my sense of it is that over time, if you build community governance from the ground up in and then network it, and it becomes widespread, it creates a groundswell of sentiment that informs the political operations and deliberations at every level above that. So this process, which if it ever happens will probably take a generation or two, that's if we could flip a switch and get everybody on board tomorrow. I still think it would take a long time to make it work. I think would eventually culminate in a sweeping change to the political culture nationwide. And this brings us to the issue of whether is a nation of 320 million, or in China's case, 1.5 billion, or a billion in India, is that actually a manageable size for a political entity? I don't really know. I'm sure there's zillions of folks who've written far more about this and have a better sense of it, but it does seem kind of unwieldy. It makes it inevitable that you're going to wind up coming down on the side of one kind of policy or another that's going to leave a lot of people out and not serve their interests. And when you have a system in which it's a winner-take-all kind of system and that somebody gets 51% of the presidential electorate vote, claims a mandate, and then proceeds, particularly if they have the control of the House and or the Senate, to claim a mandate and basically refuse to honor the reservations of the tens of millions of people that didn't vote for them, I think that's a prescription for the kind of gridlock and disaster that we've seen, especially recently. And I do think that a widespread and deeply rooted culture of deliberative civic engagement that was could be seen everywhere in the country would help mitigate that kind of tendency.
Well, it disturbs me every time I hear the office of the President of the United States described as the position of the most powerful person in the world. And I'm thinking, why should our country be the most powerful country in the world and have this one individual who's the most powerful person in the world? It seems, on the other hand, I heard a story the other day on the radio about the program was started in Slovenia, and they were talking about this, and I don't actually remember what the program was about, but it sounded very inspiring, and they were talking about how the small country could have something so innovative and so visionary. And it seems to me that if we could break down the country into smaller units, and they could be autonomous and maybe connected federally, like sort of like the model of the EU, that it might make more sense, and that maybe we could actually have ways of governing and ways that we listen to each other.
You might be right. I don't know. I don't know. It's I guess it's an empirical question. You know, there are some time-honored books out there, The Nine Nations of North America, for instance, that suggest that you know, the kinds of political organizations, if you look at a map of the United States, there's a whole lot of straight lines on there that are just grid lines. They just follow a cartographer's straight edge, really. They have nothing to do with what's happening on the ground and don't really help form natural, say, watershed bases for governing particular zones and regions. And people have argued that the United States is really an uncomfortable mix of 7 or 8 or 10 different areas, depending on who's counting, that don't really belong together. And I don't know, maybe there's something to that. It's fun to think about. I don't know where it's actually going to go. I guess we'll find out if we live long enough.
Well, maybe the next time we talk, we can think more about that one. But I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning, Tom. We've been talking with Tom Prue, who's senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and co-director of the State of the World Project, and I hope to have you back on again sometime.
Thanks. Thanks, Barbara. I hope to be back.
Okay, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with Tom Prue, who's senior researcher at the World Watch Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll hear a rebroadcast of a show from the summer featuring Clatsop anti-LNG activist Lori Kaplan. I'll be back live in 2 weeks when my guest will be Michael Abelman, author of Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Hugh Masekela. Thanks for listening.
I want to be there when the people start to turn it around, when they triumph over poverty. I wanna be there when the people win the battle against AIDS. I wanna lend a hand. I wanna be there for the alcoholic. I wanna be there for the drug addict. I wanna be there for the victims of violence and abuse. I wanna lend a hand. Send